Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. In Afghanistan, it is pretty clear that there was an intelligence gathering foul-up, and as a result, the United States bombed the village and killed and wounded dozens of civilians when the American military thought that there would be Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces as targets. In Iraq, the United States is going ahead with plans to make war on Saddam Hussein, even though this country's allies might not be in agreement. The countries of Africa have met to form an African Union similar to the European Union, and in Barcelona, Spain, the annual Worldwide AIDS Epidemic Conference has learned that the disease could leave 20 million orphans in Africa by the year 2010, and that could be the saddest story that we're going to talk about today. To discuss these stories, we have in Johannesburg, South Africa, Raymond Lowe, editor and publisher of the South African Report. In Kabul, Afghanistan, Carlotta Gall of the New York Times. In Moscow, Alexander Goltz, senior editor of the political desk of Yezhenny Journal. And in London, Simon Tisdall, assistant editor of The Guardian. Let's start in South Africa. Raymond Lowe, tell us a little bit about this new African Union, what it means, and what the prospects are for its success.
It's a successor to the Organization of African Unity, which has existed for some 39 years, and which was drawn up to combat colonialism in Africa generally. The key feature of the Organization of African Unity was that all states retained their sovereignty, and the organization could not interfere. The main difference between that institution and the African Union is that the sovereignty issue has been swept aside, and the African Union plans to set up a kind of a security council, which will have powers to intervene in countries where there are human rights abuses and bad governance and general mayhem. It's a key feature of the African Union, and it's going to make an enormous difference if the Union actually gets off the ground properly. That is, to be able to interfere in affairs of countries which are not behaving themselves.
Is Robert Mugabe going to allow interference, for example, in Zimbabwe by the African Union against some of his policies?
Well, let's put that question slightly differently and say, are there a whole range of tyrants in Africa, apart from Robert Mugabe, going to allow interference? Well, they've all signed on the dotted line, including Mugabe, for the African Union. It now depends on how the African Union faces up to the challenge. They are going to set up what is called a peer review mechanism of some 20, a panel of some 20 states or representatives of 20 states who are going to assess the good governance practices of the various member states against which complaints have been levied. And it will be salutary to see whether, in fact, that panel and that mechanism works to the extent of saying to the African Union Security Council, well, here's a prime case for you to intervene. They have already taken action against Madagascar. They have precluded Madagascar from being part of the opening or the launching of the African Union because the elections there were flawed. And they say that Madagascar can only take its seat once it's conducted fresh elections, which are free and fair.
Yeah, Simon.
But of course, Madagascar is a long way off. I sense that the real problem, as you quite rightly pointed out, is Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring Simon Tisdall into this discussion. Simon, do you see any good comparisons between the African Union and the European Union?
Well, Stuart, there's been a lot of skepticism in the reporting here of the inaugural meeting of the African Union, with some diplomats describing it as a talking shop, and various people pointing out that it's failed to agree, for instance, what to do with the debts accruing from the OAU, and couldn't even agree on the venue or chairmanship of its next meeting. But I don't think that's entirely fair. If you look at the example of the European Union, which has a far smaller membership, even after enlargement, only 25 countries compared with the African Union, almost double that, and given the mess that the European Union has made of all sorts of policies, from agriculture to defence over the last 25 years, you can't say that the Europeans have a lot to crow about, and I think we should try and support this organisation in bringing better governance to Africa.
Well, I think if I could just add on to that, the scepticism is quite broad here too, because the OAU, although it has been vaunted in the rhetoric as being the organization that brought an end to colonialism in Africa, it was in fact nothing more than a talking shop and did very little. But this thing has got a driving force behind it in the sense that there's an economic basis to rewards to be gained for good governance and for introducing democracy.
Yeah, I think that skepticism is the key word today in our discussions, and there is a lot of skepticism about what happened in Afghanistan with the bombing last week of civilians and the death and wounding of dozens of civilians. Carlotta Gall, you have taken a look at that rather carefully, and what can you tell us about what happened? Was it a major intelligence breakdown?
It seems it was an intelligence breakdown on several levels. Definitely they went in with a very big operation of 400 American and Afghan troops, and they arrested five men in the end, none of whom were senior Taliban members as they had hoped. Far more important was that at the same time they bombed four villages in this whole attack and killed as many as 50 people and wounded 120, all of whom were civilians. And I saw many of the victims in the hospital and in the village. They're women and children mostly who were gathered for an engagement party. I think the second level of intelligence failing was not only was the original information false, which probably came from an Afghan source or the local Afghan intelligence services, but they then, the Americans, when they thought they were being attacked, they then reacted with an extraordinary use of force, bombing the village without apparently a thought for the civilians living in the village. And that's what caused the worst of the damage. Now, there's debate over whether they were fired upon or not, but most Afghan officials down there doubt that they were really being fired upon and that they mistook some general celebratory fire at the wedding parties for an attack, and that the, you know, they then bombed the village with an extraordinary use of force, which has caused very, very bad feelings down in southern Afghanistan.
Bad feelings among Afghans, of course. What about the United States military? Is it at all remorseful about what it has done?
Well, there's been strange reactions, obviously, from the Pentagon, who stalled on it and were very reluctant at first to admit what they knew. But when I went to the village itself, the villagers said that the American soldiers who came in at dawn, just hours after the bombing, saw the casualties, even helped gather up the wounded children and women. And they said that they were appalled and saddened by what they saw. And certainly in Kandahar, other Western officials have said there has been, some concern among the American military. So I think the guys on the ground, when they realized what had happened, must have reacted like any normal human being, appalled at the mistake. But
yeah,
the official reaction, of course, has been muted and reluctant. They've acknowledged the casualties, but they haven't actually come out with a full apology yet.
Yeah, Carlotta, you have had great experience as a war correspondent, not only in Afghanistan, but also in the Balkans and in Chechnya. As a matter of fact, I think you wrote a book about Chechnya.
Right.
Intelligence is a big problem in all of these places. What can be done to improve intelligence gathering in Afghanistan? And I'd like to hear from Alexander Goltz about that also, because I think that the United States has been relying to a great extent on Russian intelligence gathering in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Yes.
I agree with you 100% that intelligence data is the biggest problem. All my experience on previous Afghan war shows that Soviet troops badly needed normal intelligence. And it looks like that no Americans, neither Russians now have no good intelligence network there. All these satellite reconnaissance and all new technique measures, they cannot solve the problem. You need agents, you need agents in the field, and you need people you can trust. And it's one of the biggest problems in Afghanistan, because you cannot trust to most of these people. And it looks like that Americans failed, as well as Russians failed before, to raise this intelligence network.
Yeah, Carlotta?
I think that's absolutely true. Everyone seems to be saying they need people on the ground. There's nothing better than that. You know, the satellite surveillance, the special forces surveillance from afar isn't enough. And interestingly, the Americans are sending in a special forces team now to live in the district where they've done so many raids recently, Darawood district of Oruzgan province, so that they can, I think, live and see on the ground what it's like. I've been up there a lot, and, you know, most villages are not Taliban. It's very clear. But how you evaluate the local intelligence is very difficult, because there are enormous tribal rivalries and scores to be settled locally, which inevitably bring in intelligence that is in the end false or unreliable.
Simon Tisdale, I think that Rudyard Kipling was talking about Afghanistan when he said, East is east and west is west, and there the twain shall meet. The British have had problems in Afghanistan also, and over decades and decades.
Well, yes, going back to the 1850s and before, and intelligence was a problem then. They had no idea what they were up against, occupied Kabul, and yeah. They discovered that the rest of the country was a different matter and were promptly driven out.
Is all of this perhaps due to just the tremendous cultural differences between those of us in the Western world and Afghans or Chechens or whatever?
Well, I don't know. I think there's lots of answers to that. You know, Afghanistan is not a nation state in the way Western Europeans understand that concept. It's a collection of tribal fiefdoms and warlordisms and various ethnic groups, religious groups. Its boundaries were artificially put together by the British, as in so many other parts of the world, including Africa. And in some ways, Afghanistan as a nation state is an artificial concept. And it is interesting that history is repeating itself in the sense that, as with the British, as with the Russians, you know, the capital Kabul is occupied and secured and seems to be getting on quite nicely now. Carlotta will tell us more about that. But the rest of the country remains a bit of a closed book. And there is no prospect at the moment, anyway, of the International Security Force or indeed the American Army subduing large tracts of Afghanistan, which remain as they've always been under the rule of the local Khans.
Okay, we have to take a break now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org, or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Before the break, we were talking about Afghanistan, but let's move to another part of the Middle East now and talk a little bit about Iraq. There was a major story in the New York Times several days ago saying that the United States military is making plans for an attack on Iraq coming from three directions, north, west, and south. Simon Tisdall, talk a little bit about how much that story, how much attention that story has gotten in Western Europe among American allies.
Well, that particular New York Times story, following on earlier accounts of supposed Pentagon plans, received a lot of attention over the weekend, and it comes along with other aspects of this developing confrontation. For instance, in the news today is the prospect that Jordan, which sided with Iraq during the Gulf War, may now be induced to provide facilities to American forces. There's a great attention being paid to the naval and other military preparations going along in the Gulf, in Qatar and Bahrain. We're very interested in the attitude of Saudi Arabia, with which Britain has some quite severe bilateral issues at the moment to do with human rights. And we're also following the situation in Turkey, where the government may be about to fall and no one's quite sure what's going to happen next. All these countries of great importance to the success of American plans. And all this is being watched against the backdrop of great European misgiving about the prospect of yet another American war being fought, after all, much closer to Europe than it is to America. And not so much the objective of toppling Saddam Hussein, which everyone thinks would be rather a good thing, but what happens next and whether the country will disintegrate and what this means for Iran and how Israel might get involved and so on.
And also what it means for Russia. Sasha?
Look, it is a very important question for Russian politicians, because a lot of people still suspect United States in imperialism. Let me say, new course of Mr. Bush gives a lot of opportunities to do so. It looks like anybody who reads attentively American documents on military build-up can say that United States is the main goal of U.S. is to gain military superiority. Now U.S. do not need any agreements with its allies. In fact, it's, Washington shows it don't need any agreements with Russia, any talks with Russia about its future military operation. And for many analysts here, it looks rather dangerous. People are very skeptical about the results of such operation.
Carlotta Gall, do you think the United States is able to maintain a strong military presence in Afghanistan and fight in Iraq at the same time?
Well, it's interesting that the U.S. general in command here said recently that he intended to keep the full strength of forces here for another year, and didn't mention Iraq. But the soldiers, although they don't say they know much, are definitely thinking of the next war. They're already, their minds are moving on. And the British troops here, who are now just pulling out, have told me that the American troops are definitely gearing up and thinking about it. So I don't know how they'll manage, but I would have thought they would pretty rapidly scale down in Afghanistan if they had to.
And what will that mean as far as Afghanistan is concerned?
Well, I think personally that they're doing very well in the regions of Afghanistan with small teams of special forces who are living with the regional governors and so on, and keeping them on board and telling them not to fight each other, and watching things quite closely. If those special forces people are pulled out, I think that could be very damaging, because they are doing essentially a peacekeeping job. And if they had to hand over to someone like the UN or an international peacekeeping force of less powerful nations, I think that they might not be able to hold the peace in Afghanistan. So I think it could be damaging. But at the moment, perhaps they could do it with the job with a few less troops. But I think if they pulled out big time, it could be very damaging for the stability of Afghanistan.
Raymond Lowe, is there any impact in South Africa or in the African countries generally, as you know it, by what is going on in the Middle East and South Asia?
Oh, in the Middle East, certainly. South Asia. Afghanistan seems to be a little far from our ken, although we report the news. We report the reported the assassination of the vice president the other day, and we reported gave quite a lot of space to the attack on the quote wedding unquote, and what happened there, but it doesn't seem to elicit a great deal of response here, except among the Muslim people who feel very strongly that innocent people are constantly being killed and not enough attention is being paid to this. For instance, one of our human rights workers and a member of parliament, Pregs Govender, who resigned from parliament the other day, makes the point that the war against terrorism is a war of terrorism. And why doesn't the killing of innocents not outrage all those who are in the business of media and communications? So there is an undercurrent of feeling here, and it's been there here all along, about particularly America's war against terrorism, that the price is too many civilian lives at stake. But of course, the country as a whole, as an institution, as a state, does support the war against terrorism.
Is it going to support a war against Saddam Hussein if such a war occurs?
Well, no. Well, in fact, South Africa made it very clear it would not support, in physical terms, the war against the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And I can't imagine that we would be supporting a war against Saddam Hussein when his Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz arrived in South Africa the other day with a red carpet welcome at the invitation of our Deputy President Jacob Zuma. And he spent 4 or 5 days in South Africa discussing various things. So in that sense, there's obviously moral support by South Africa, although South Africa hasn't, as far as I know, I haven't been able to find any reference to it, hasn't made any official statement on the American threat against Iraq. But there's Tariq Aziz has come to this country and spent 5 days here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when he was met at the airport, it wasn't only by Jacob Zuma, but also the transport minister and a number of other South African ministers.
Right. Raymond, if I could, I'd like to change the subject a little bit and talk about AIDS and the AIDS conference and the crippling AIDS epidemic in Africa. The story that I mentioned at the beginning of the program about the possibility of 20 million orphaned children in Africa within the next 7 or 8 years. How is that being greeted in South Africa, and what is being done to try to control that problem?
Well, you're really talking about the great controversy that, in fact, has made us, in many senses, our government, the laughingstock of the world. A tragic laughingstock of the world, should I add, for its policies towards the treatment of AIDS. There's our president who, at one stage sided with the dissidents that AIDS is not caused by the HIV virus and caused uproar. And there's also a very strong civil society movement urging the government constantly to take action and to take proper action. And actually, only the other day, in fact a few days ago, we had a watershed decision against the government by our constitutional court for the government's tardiness in the supply of antiretroviral drugs to pregnant women and their babies to prevent the spread of AIDS among babies, and thus, of course, creating an and first of all among the mothers, the orphan population. At least, sorry, as a result of the deaths of the mothers, creating an orphan population, and then the eventual death of the orphans themselves. It's an ongoing argument here of considerable dimension, which has split the country to a certain degree. That is, the pro-government people who support what the government is doing, what the government is not doing, and the activists who are anxious that the government should do more.
Yeah, Carlotta, what is the AIDS situation in Afghanistan?
I don't think anyone knows. They're fighting some very basic problems here. There's a huge infant mortality, but just from malnutrition and starvation and disease. There's enormous maternal mortality of women dying in childbirth, one of the highest in the world. They're only just doing surveys of those sort of things. That no one has an idea about AIDS. But
yeah.
I think people are aware of the surrounding countries and their problems, particularly in Central Asia and in Asia itself. No one has an idea.
Right. I was just going to say that in Central Asia and in Russia, there is a growing AIDS problem, and the conventional wisdom is that it came from drug problems that developed among Soviet troops during Soviet times in Afghanistan. Sasha, is the Russian government facing up to the AIDS problem in your country?
Yes. Russian government thinks about AIDS problem as one of the main threats to the health of our people, and unfortunately, we have some regions where AIDS problem looks not as epidemic, but near to epidemic. One of the worst situation is in Kaliningrad, which is a Russian enclave in the Baltics. As normally in the period of some economical and political mess, such diseases as AIDS can spread very quickly.
Okay, we have...
Yeah.
Sasha, I'm sorry, we have 1 minute left, and I would like Simon Tisdall to talk just a little bit for a few seconds about the AIDS problem in England.
Well, it's been growing like everywhere else, and people are very concerned about it. But in the African context, which has been the focus during this Barcelona conference, you know, we come back basically to the discussion we had earlier about the African Union. Here is a really big, important, crucial challenge for the African countries, which they can only deal with together, it seems.
Right, Simon.
People have written.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I do have to cut you off, and that's too bad, but we are out of time. Our guests today have been in London, Simon Tisdall of The Guardian, in Moscow, Alexander Galtz of Yezhnedelny Journal, in Kabul, Carlotta Gall of the New York Times, and in Johannesburg, South Africa, Raymond Lowe, editor and publisher of South Africa Report. Our director is Pat Akers and our producer, Mariana DeMaio. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.